listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden. I find the sea calming. I grew up coastal and the sea was nice to be in and on and around. I really liked the sound and I liked the enormity of it.
In a video.
Then I saw these videos. YouTube is full of these videos. Young people, old people, babies and pets seeing the sea for the first time. Yeah, they seem in awe and the videos really push you in that direction. But what I wasn't expecting is that all of them seem a little bit scared. You can kind of see it in their eyes. And I guess the sea is kind of scary. When you're confronted with something as big and awesome and powerful as the sea, you stop seeing it as a whole and you dissect it, take it apart and process it. Make sense of it and look for a point of reference, something to grasp onto. And I think that's what these people haven't built up yet. You stare at the sea for the first time and you have to choose whether you want to jump in and stay or to go really, really far away. Jacqueline Breen wasn't scared of the ocean, but she still ended up in Broken Hill. It's about 1,100 kilometres away from the seaside. And she found some other sea lovers away from the waves. Also, she swears like a sailor in this one. Just a heads up.
Oh my god. Fuck off, flies. Ew, I will pay you in fly money if you go away. Alright, let's see.
I'm in the outback on the edge of town. I'm in a dry, barren dirt pit, the Broken Hill tip. It's hot and dusty. There's plastic bags blown up and flapping against cyclone fences like they're trying to get away. Everything is bleached from the sun and looks brittle and salty.
It smells disgusting. I'm surrounded by dirt and plastic and bits of cardboard, a couple of buckets, a heap of bottles, and over there I think I can see some seagulls. Oh, no, wait. They're galahs. They're the galahs. I wonder why it smells like piss.
I came here a year ago, leaving everyone and everything I knew back by the sea. I came here for a job and because I wasn't sure what else to do. And so I found myself working long hours and then wondering what to do in the middle of nowhere on the weekends. I found myself driving out by the tip one Saturday morning and I heard some very familiar sort of squawking sounds and I slowed down. There was a big, noisy, ugly, bratty pack of seagulls fighting over soiled diapers and empty cans of Forex. They looked like they were a long way from home, and I found myself asking them the same question I was asking myself. What the hell are you doing here?
You have called BirdLife Australia. If you know the extension you wish to dial, simply dial the extension number now, or alternatively, dial 3...
How good is it that BirdLife Australia magazine's hold music is not actually hold music, but a tranquil soundscape of rainforest bird songs?
Hello, Sean speaking.
Hi, Sean. It's Jack again.
Oh, g'day.
Sean Dooley is editor. I asked him how he wound up in the job.
I was always, right from an early age, I was a bit of a bird nerd. And
in fact, his first memory is of birds.
I can remember as a four-year-old getting up in the morning and opening the front door of the house and wandering down the street to try and find what I thought was an owl calling. And it turned out it wasn't an owl, it was a dove. And... Yeah, and then and I also remember my mum freaking out too.
But we digressed. I told him about the displaced seagulls. He said it didn't surprise him.
It doesn't, actually. It's not that unusual. The well, the nearest coast is actually in South Australia to Broken Hill. That's probably about 450 kilometres away. It still seems a long way for a seabird to fly. But the key here is that the bird you're talking about is actually a silver gull. I think there's about 80 species of seagulls around the world, and they're not all confined to the coastline or the seas. And the silver gull will go inland along the big rivers, and also it goes a long way inland in wet times when the when there's been floods and sort of salt lakes, inland salt lakes start to fill, mainly because they know there's a good feed, because a lot of water birds turn up at those flooded lakes and start breeding, like pelicans. And so the silver gulls, which are scavengers, will turn up and scavenge around the nesting colonies of the water birds. So if they can go as far as Lake Eyre or Alice Springs, some birds will obviously at some stage pass over Broken Hill. And being scavengers, they would have been attracted by the tip where there's a free feed for them. But they're constantly going out and searching for new food, and we don't really know what triggers these water birds and coastal birds to actually go inland. But they do seem to know, and there's all these different theories that they can detect changes in air pressure, or they hear the infrasound of the thunderstorms that are going to create the the wetland. So apparently,
what's an infrasound?
Infrasound is the sound on sort of at the wavelength of sound. You know, you've got the ultra high frequency that, you know, only dogs can hear. Infrasound is the ultra low frequency that human beings can't hear, but animals like elephants apparently can hear, and we think birds can as well.
A low, low, distant rumble, I imagine, like thunder.
It's not proven that that's why they head there. It's just a theory, but it does hold some water, so to speak.
You don't need to prove anything to me. I'm 10 towards the sort of whimsical at the best of times. That's why I've gotten so attached to these seagulls, and why I care that they're now missing, because I come from the coast, because I'm living away from home in the desert, and I'd come to think quite fondly of these guys as my fellow coastal expats.
Sort of like your totem birds.
Yeah, I guess so. As I said, they're gone now. They've abandoned me in the desert. And do you think they'll come back?
Perhaps not those individual birds, but undoubtedly silver gulls will come back to Broken Hill. It's been a pretty dry time from all accounts.
So for them to return, it would be a matter of conditions changing? There's nothing that I can do to change their minds?
No, probably not.
So there's my answer, or part of it, at least. That is what the hell the birds are doing here. As for me, what the hell am I doing here? Was it the right choice? Am I helping? Am I happy? Some days I don't know. But some days I do.
That story was produced by Jacqueline Breen. While the government maintained silence on the boats of asylum seekers arriving in Australia and made it harder for information about them to be reported, Rebecca Giggs began to pay attention to the boats that were being talked about. Boats that went down in Uganda, Bangladesh, South Korea, in lakes and oceans and rivers.
That was the year just passed in which silence turned from an absence of information into a palpable presence. A character recruited into the national story by the Department of Immigration and Border Protection. Silence who balked in press conferences, shrugged at doorstops, and sighed in the High Court's public gallery. Silence who sucked its teeth, said no single thing on the end of the line, put a hand over the microphone to mute the minister. To talk around silence meant to talk indirectly, by which I mean to talk with that curated misdirection known as spin. It's a kind of art spin, not one to believe in, though few would deny that the presence of silence was a creative agitator that year. Sometimes it felt that political language had become so blurred, spun like a globe on a pivot, that the poles of the public sphere were shifting beneath us. An inch, another, magnetic, inaudible, irreversible. Those same statements whipping round and around. Illegal maritime arrival. Operation Sovereign Borders. Operation Sovereign Borders. Illegal maritime arrival.
Deterrent.
At least that's the way it seemed where I was. The queasiness of a centre giving way underneath it all. And exhausting to hear only silence, to guess at its taciturn gestures. Could you make a tool from misdirection, acting on a spun world that in fact got closer to some kind of useful truth? Tell it slant, the poet's maxim. So while I was listening for what wasn't being said about the boats that weren't being talked about, I also began to pay attention to those that were. Boats that went down in Uganda, Bangladesh, South Korea, in lakes, oceans and rivers. Cruisers, tankers, yachts and ferries. But only the ferries made the world news. I heard that Captain Lee Jun-suk was not at the helm of the MV Seawall when the boat began to cant into the Yellow Sea. The third mate, 25 years old, her first time commanding the bridge, she shrunk from the controls. She screamed, and she did not stop screaming. I heard Lee was in his cabin. 10 minutes later, Lee told his passengers not to move. Two engineers shared a stumbling beer in a corridor growing steeper. No life jackets were distributed, no lifeboats unstowed. The expense of the crew's safety training was recorded in one budget as $2. This was the price of a paper certificate that they filed in a drawer. A high school student phoned emergency services in South Korea while the freight deck flooded. Loose cars bumping against the bulkheads. 325 students were aboard, their annual field trip. I heard that afterwards, when 247 of those students had drowned, along with 57 others, Lee did not identify himself to the Coast Guard as the Seawall's captain. He abandoned the ship while people waited for direction. That student, raising the alarm, he didn't survive, and though his school's vice principal did, on land he took his own life. The water was black, but it wasn't icy. A landmass was dimly visible. Lee was among the first to be rescued. Others were recovered afterwards. Bodies and body parts, that is, turned blue on the seafloor. Some were not recovered. For a long time, the Seawall's intercom broadcast, "Do not move. Stay where you are. It's dangerous if you move, so just stay where you are." A bump in sea time. The Seawall had just sailed over the anniversary named Titanic. 102 years since that luxury ship's cold April sinking. A superstitious date. And though the Seawall turned under on the 16th, back across the date line where the Titanic went down, it remained a calendar day earlier. While the Seawall sunk then, rituals, wreaths, speeches and contemplations marked out more distant historical deaths worldwide. It's the yellow ribbon now, to remember the Seawall lying in the Yellow Sea. Lawyers petitioned on the death penalty for Lee. He'll do 36 years, or less, as he's 69, he'll do the rest of his life. What sense is tripped when a situation becomes unwritable? Here in Australia, I've been trying to define the faculties that light that moment up. Below deck, the theatre of the yaw is slower and more subtle. A fork slides, just a little, towards the glasses. Askew, a painting reveals the brighter edge of wallpaper beneath it. Tilt your head, place the piece of cutlery back on its spot. How quickly we've adapted to a slanted life. An inch each day. Is it any wonder it feels like farce? One part Charlie Chaplin, one part Roald Dahl, to two parts George Orwell. Sometimes there's a yell from above, although the message isn't clear. In cabins meant for one or two, cabins that are, if we're honest, plush like coffins or cots are plush, the captain's voice repeats, "Stay where you are. It's dangerous if you move." It's a machine voice. Of course it's hard, in warm rooms, in a cosy bed, or a bath that's becoming just a little deeper at one end, to sustain real empathy with the trauma of those people who you know are up there, who are out there screaming. People who've already swung past the axis of no return, who see their horizon tipping. It's as if they were on another boat. You can see them sometimes through the porthole, these other boats. Wood, fiberglass and tin, a dark flotilla. There's no soundtrack to this dream. All drowned in one way or another, people who steadfast refuse to go down with the ship. When you wake, it takes a moment to settle into the fact that this vision isn't true. They are us and we are them. Some common humanity is degraded to call this struggling sea a dream. We're all in the same boat. The owner of the Seawall was known as the millionaire with no face. Before the Seawall, I heard he'd started a cult. I heard he'd registered the domain name god.com. He'd patented types of gadgetry for colonics, gained a seventh degree black belt in Taekwondo, ran an organic lavender plantation, and exhibited his photographs at the Louvre in Paris. Well, in a pavilion in a garden at the Louvre, which he paid for. He had a face, naturally enough, and though he didn't like to show it, the deduction the man was free of vanity is misplaced. See Yu Bion Young online, one still image. A light gold suit with a gold necktie, gold-rimmed glasses, satin hair. A headset, gold microphone reaching its antenna around his soft golden cheek. The colonic irrigation system he invented was housed in gold casing. His name is still etched in gold on a marble wall of donors in a Parisian museum. When the boat went down, you disappeared. The international manhunt proposed a six-figure reward. Then he turned up dead in a field. It was a plum field. I heard the words, "Love like a dream," were handwritten in the lining of his bag, and that he carried a bottle of tablets made from desiccated sharks. One of his hands was supposed to be entirely decayed, and the other one was all dried out, as though he was stranded between a liquid world and a solid one. It took 2.5 hours for the Seawall to sink, but after 15 minutes, it was clear that it would. There's a feeling in your stomach that you can trust, a pocket of air flipping over. I guess what I'm saying is this. You have to get up and leave the cabin, leave the studio to call out to say things have gone too far. Good captains are few and far between. In the story of the Seawall, the golden industrialist turns into a dried out god, facing up to little. It's a story we hear a lot of these days, though mutinies are still unpopular. Sitting down to dinner in a room that's rolling, turning a cloth ear to those voices from the sea. That kind of blitheness calls up the same qualities we fault you and Lee for. Ego, cowardice, self-interest, avarice. Love like a dream. That was Yu's hidden testament. And in dreams we're so often silent, trying and failing to talk. That was the year Silence hid screams in the water, and Silence hid hopes of a better polity. But love, love is not like a dream, and neither is rage, and neither is mercy.
That story was written and performed by Rebecca Giggs, with sound design by Heidi Pett. It was first published by Right Now, a human rights media organisation, as part of their essay series, which is funded by the Australian Government through the Australia Council. You can read more of the series at rightnow.org.au. There are some things we take for granted, and sight is definitely one of them. It's hard to appreciate how incredible it is unless it starts to fade away. For Dane, a 21-year-old living on the northern beaches of Sydney, this happened gradually but surely. Producer Aidan Malines talked to him about his experience with Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy.
Really, be sad. I mean, people, yeah. Shit happens. Yeah. Life sucks. No. Things get hard and things get rough, but I just don't. Like, if I stopped, I would never go back, you know, because there's a big thing. Once you get the ball rolling, once you get momentum behind you, you just keep going.
When most people want to go for a sail, they think of these picturesque, serene conditions. Like a cloudless blue sky, sun overhead. There's nothing more excruciating than going out on the water only to be caught in limbo. You're just sitting there. Still.
I'm Dane, I'm 21, and I live on the northern beaches in Sydney. I have recently finished an exercise and sports science degree at ACU. I'm big into fitness and being active as a person and being active socially. I'm very big on keeping yourself occupied, you know, with people and, you know, maintaining connections with as many people as possible. This is late December 2013. Just nothing really in particular. I just noticed when I looked at like screens and technology, like mainly my alarm clock and things seemed a little blurry, but it wasn't impacting me at all. So like as a few weeks went on, I didn't do anything about it because I thought, whatever, it's nothing. You know, I'm a guy. I feel like nothing's wrong. So early January, I started to notice in my right eye, a little bit of a blind spot. Thought, okay, maybe something is up. Went down to just the local optometrist, who told me nothing was wrong. Everything was fine. And I was like, well, I'm pretty sure something's wrong. I can't really see. So we went to a higher end optometrist, who again couldn't see anything wrong with me, but she recommended me on to an expert. And so I went up there, and he looked at me. He picked up on it straight away because he's been around a little while. At this stage, Mum had started doing her own research, going through old files and stuff of her grandma and stuff. And I remember sitting in the office and Mum and the doctor looking at each other. And Mum was like, it's Leber's, isn't it? And I was like, what's Leber's? At first, it was even scarier at first. People were like, as things were starting to get blurry, I'd look at people's faces and it looked like, when I'd look at someone's face, it looked like they had no eyes or mouth. Just black spots. I don't know, there was a period of time when my eyesight was at that level where I'd look at people and it definitely looked like something out of a horror movie. I was in denial the whole time. You know, even now I keep thinking I'm going to wake up and it's, because it hasn't been that long still, I keep thinking, I'm still not entirely used to it. Like I wake up and think, oh, I'm going to see. It could get worse in a matter of months. It could get worse over 6 years. You could go completely blind or you could only lose a little bit of your vision. There's no way for me to tell. But in general, it is a drastic loss of sight and there is no recovery. Yeah, Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy. I just call it LHON for short. To be honest, I don't know a huge amount about it. The way it works is it actually affects the optic nerve, which is the connection from the brain to the eye that interprets sight, and it affects the mitochondria in the optic nerve, which are kind of like the powerhouses of of the nerve cell. So it's just parts of it don't have energy to receive and interpret sight. So it's actually not a problem with the eyeball at all, which is why it took so long to get diagnosed, because every optometrist you go to and stuff, like, they just look straight at your eyeball and tell me, you know, everything's fine, there's nothing wrong with your lenses or anything. Getting to places is a big thing. I walk a lot. I walk because I walk to and from my gym, you know, 4 or 5 days a week, and there's a road there with no traffic lights that gets pretty busy through the day, which can sometimes be challenging, but I haven't run into an issue yet, but it can be a bit daunting. I don't like to go somewhere socially to meet up with people unless I'm going with someone, because I can't walk into a place and see people on the other side and say, my friends are over there. I can't recognize people. Even where you're sitting to me now, I can't see your face, you know. Right. That's why I like going with someone, so someone can go in front of me and say, oh, this is that person, and I know they're wearing that tonight, you know. I rely on other things now, like once I say hi to someone on the night, I know what they're wearing, and I can identify that easier than I can their face from across the room. You know, I certainly think it has changed my life. It's changed it, but hasn't stopped it, you know. Like, my original goal, like I said, I studied exercise and sports science at ACU. My goal was to work as a strength and conditioning coach with elite athletes, you know, sporting applications and game day things with running around, watching people play sport and stuff. And obviously I can't do that. I mean, there might be ways around that, but I haven't figured that out yet. I spent time in my uni gym training cancer patients 2 days a week, just basic resistance training. They'd been through all their therapy and stuff, and they didn't really need any much rehabilitation. Although I did have one guy that I worked with who was overweight. He's had prostate cancer. He'd had a hip replacement, and he had an amputated leg. But he was very good to work with, and it was very positive. And I started working with them probably about 7 months after my diagnosis. But that was very interesting in a way, because it was sort of very relatable with a lot of them, because they've all been through a very similar hardship. Some of them were also legally blind. So they've all also been through a hardship. And so I guess there was a mutual respect between us, and they were all there to try and improve themselves, and I was there to help them. And so they appreciated my being there, and they understood my limitations. Even though when I went to the gym full of people with cancer and injury and problems and arms they can't move properly, and man with an amputated leg, that was still a more positive environment, I felt, at times. And I don't think that's a reflection on my gym. That's the same at every gym I've been to. I just felt like that was a group of people with a mutual understanding, and so the whole environment was improved, you know?
All of a sudden, right, you've found yourself out past the heads, and the clouds come in, and the wind picks up to like 35 knots, and something's happened. You can't put down the mainsail. You're head to toe with salt, and you've got a tack, and the sail's blacking. But most of all, you're bloody moving. That feeling of actually going through the water, it makes you feel like you've actually got a reason to be there.
But, like, the people that just have slight problems, you know, and letting it hold them down for ages and stuff, or just little things, and having trouble at work, and then they stress out, and I'm not going to do anything tonight because I'm so upset and everything. And I'm like, I lost my eyesight when I was 20. I don't say that in a bragging way, but, like, I just feel like people can relax, and if you don't take everything so seriously, you'll move through things easier. I mean, I've been through a breakup, I've done all that, and obviously things are hard. That's a part of life, and you should get upset about things, but I just don't think people seem to hold on to things too long. I just don't see any point in slowing down or shutting down. I don't think that's going to help anything, and I don't think you're going to get any further in life if you let this define you. That's a funny statement, because I don't know what it was. I remember hanging out with, like, I'd seen a lot of doctors, and I'd seen people telling me, you know, stay in there, stay positive, and all this crap. you know, people telling me stupid motivational things or whatever. And I just never really cared for it. I was like, this is dumb. And I remember hanging out with a friend one night and she just said, don't let it define you. I don't know what it was, but that just stuck with me. I don't know, because it was a friend saying it. It wasn't some person I've never heard before, I've never seen before online. It wasn't a doctor who says this to 20 patients a day or something. I don't know if what it was. And, it, you know, it's a stupid, it's a weird little saying, but I just thought, you know, just don't let it define you. Like I said, like I've said a number of times, I don't stress too much and I don't take things too seriously. So, I don't know, I'm very relaxed and I keep very chill. And I think attitude is a big thing when something like this happens. It's like the way you look at it. Like, I know a lot of people, and I know I could have very easily just shut down. Well, actually, I probably couldn't have easily. If I shut down, I wouldn't have forgiven myself, you know.
That piece was produced by Aidan Malines, thanks to Dane Hill and actor Craig Coventry.
The ships sail off without me. The aeroplane lifts off and over the sea. I am always the one at the window, waiting and watching for my turn to be on the other side of the table. 100 years old, but it feels new to me. I give all my time to be able to taste the leaves at the top of the...
This episode of All The Best was produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and Triple R in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to all the producers who contributed to this episode, Jacqueline Breen and Aidan Malines, as well as Rebecca Giggs for reading her story, The Boat, and Rosalina Press, Editor-in-Chief at Right Now. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jess O'Callaghan, my co-host is Pip Rasmussen, and I'm Michael Bryden. All The Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
Green olives and possibly, but morning.